This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio. Catholic Review Radio is a weekly radio program and podcast hosted by Catholic Review Media, the news operation of the Archdiocese of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic partners for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to our listeners each week.
Welcome to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matusek. In the early years of the United States, the Catholic Church was small and still learning how to live within a new culture of religious freedom and democracy. One of the most intriguing figures of that moment was Prince Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin, a Russian nobleman who gave up wealth and status to become a Catholic priest on the American frontier. After arriving in America, Gallitzin traveled to Baltimore, where he met and spoke with Bishop John Carroll, the first Catholic bishop in the United States. After his ordination, one of Gallitzin's first assignments was serving as pastor of St. Joseph Church in Tawneytown. He would become a circuit riding priest who traveled on horseback and was later known as the Apostle of the Alleghenies. Yet Gallitzin's strong personality and independent ideas about how the church should grow in this new environment placed him in tension with his bishop. Joining us to talk about this remarkable man is Catherine O'Donnell, professor of history at Arizona State University. O'Donnell, who holds a doctorate in history from the University of Michigan, is the author of three books, including one on St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. She has just published an essay on Gallitzin in U.S. Catholic Historian. Catherine, thanks so much for being here on Catholic Review Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back again. So we're talking about a man whose godmother was Catherine the Great. He grew up in sophisticated intellectual circles in Europe, and yet he ended up in the American wilderness, administering sacraments and traveling on horseback. How did that happen? How did that all transpire?
Everything about him is unexpected. So absolutely, he comes from this fascinating, educated, so Russian family. And his father is an ambassador and very interested in Enlightenment science and so forth. But I really think it's his mother who is key to the person he became, including to the ways he rebelled. So she raised Demetrius and his sister in a almost like an Enlightenment experiment at first, lots of fresh air and philosophy. And then she converted to Catholicism, and he, as a teenager, converted along with her. But she just made everything up as she went along. She was a really strong personality and really hard on her son. Out of love, one assumes, but just really hard. And so the father and mother agreed that they would send Dmitri to the United States, really to get him out of the way of Napoleon and kind of bloodshed. And then he'd come back and take up his place in Europe. But on arrival, he had been placed kind of in the care of Bishop Carroll. And Carroll politely said, well, I'm sorry, we can't take you on a grand tour with priests as chaperones. That's not the way this country works. How about we put you in St. Mary's Seminary to start off? And Dmitri loved it. He loved the education. He loved the priesthood. He decided he wanted to be a priest, and he was not going to return to Europe. And he never did, including when it would have made a lot of sense, when there were some deaths in his family. Kind of obvious thing to do was return and find a way to claim some of his inheritance, not to use for himself, but to use for his congregation, and who just was never going back. And I feel like maybe part of that may have been he made a life apart from the strong will of his mother, and he was going to stay in the States.
And his mother was really hard on him too, wasn't it? You referenced a letter in your essay. Could you talk about that?
Oh my goodness, yeah. So Amalia wrote to him on his birthday when he turned 14, and it's a letter that says more or less, well, you're completely unsatisfactory, and perhaps now you'll begin to improve yourself. And you think, oh my goodness, happy birthday. And there are a couple of other moments like that too, where it's just really scathing. And he told a fellow priest who ended up writing a memoir of Gallitzin something like, I really did not appreciate my mother until I was away from her. And I felt that he had some wonderful line, wonderful, terrible line, like, I felt like I couldn't even cough or blow my nose without having to explain it philosophically to my mother. And even reading the few letters from her that survived, you just completely understand why he felt that way.
What attracted him to the priesthood? Why did he want to be a priest, specifically in this new world? It was very different from where he came from.
Yeah, that was such a great question. And I mean, he does appear to have had a vocation, right? He was devout. He found comfort in the church. He loved the ritual life and the sacraments of the church. He also understood it as a profession, right? And I don't mean this in a cynical way at all. He needed to find a way to live his life. And this was a workable way. And I come to that conclusion less by what he said at the time, because we don't have that then, and more by the advice he later gave people who wrote to him. And he explained the priesthood as a good way to live, you know, if you were able to live within its vows. It made sense. And I think also, and here I'm edging more and more into speculation, but you know, historians, the documents don't tell us everything, right? I feel like as much as he rebelled against his mother, he has a little bit of his mother in him. And she made this world, right? She literally took her children away from her husband's household with his agreement and just invented different little tiny societies for them. And Gallitzin himself was never going to be able to invent a new way of being Catholic, really, in the old world, or it would have been much more difficult. And even in parts of the United States, he couldn't fit in, like Maryland was too settled for him. But in this rural part of Pennsylvania, the Alleghenies, as you said, he could really try to create a kind of what he called a Catholic calling. And so sort of like his mother, but to different purposes, he created a new world.
Could you talk about the state of the Catholic Church in the United States at that time? I think a lot of people forget that when we're talking about the Catholic Church then, it was what, 35 or 40 priests in the whole country or
That's
something?
exactly right. Yes. Just about four, fewer than 40 priests, a tiny minority. John Carroll, the bishop, when you the only bishop, right, with the diocese headquartered in Baltimore, but he's responsible for all of the United States. And when you read through John Carroll's letters, he's just constantly looking for priests that he can send places. Then sometimes he'll have a priest and he'll realize, this is maybe not working out particularly well. You know, a priest who might have gotten into trouble for various reasons in Europe sometimes would come to the United States for a fresh start. Carroll was really very open to possibilities, but did have to discipline priests. Fairly often. And there was a lot of mistrust of Catholics also. There was still a sense that had, of course, been very prominent in England that Catholics were loyal to each other and to the Pope and not to the country where they found themselves. So there was concern about whether they should hold office, about whether Catholics should be trusted. This isn't like the early Republic isn't a particularly intense moment of that. It would become more intense with the immigration, right, of the 1840s and 50s. But anti-popery, anti-Catholicism was always a tool in the toolbox. And it was very much alive in the world that Gallitzin inhabited. So yeah, it was It was not powerful. It had too few priests. It had to defend itself against all kinds of prejudices, really in a distinctive situation.
Now, Gallitzin himself had sort of an imperial style about him that really went against the grain of his bishop, John Carroll, who had a more democratic vision of what the church could be and how Catholics could integrate within American society. Could you talk about that tension?
This is part of what I mean, part of what attracted me to Gallitzin to write an article is just what a story this guy is, right? Like as you said. But also he really does have a different vision of how he should behave as a priest and what Catholicism should be different to John Carroll's. So he expected to be a kind of father to his congregation in a very assertive way. As far as he was concerned, he was responsible not just for their spiritual well-being, but for their economic well-being, for their political choices. I think of him as imagining himself as like a missionary, but also kind of like a squire, you know, like a lord kind of a little patch of ground. And I'm describing it as benevolent, and I do believe he understood it as benevolent, right? But he was quick to scold. He would prohibit people from taking communion, prohibit people from entering the church if they had offended him. And John Carroll, who is just a wonderful, patient presence. I'm an administrator at my university, and I try to think, what would John Carroll do? And it's usually he would not write that email, Catherine, or at least he would not send that email. In his letters, his very patient letters to Gallitzin, he's suggesting like, well, I don't know if allowing your horse to graze on a graveyard is a sin, really, or I don't know whether you should always be extending your influence as much as possible at every moment. There's even a point at which Gallitzin, because of this imperious manner and some rumors that he's accidentally provoked, is so concerned for his well-being, he starts carrying a gun. And he tells Carroll about it. He thinks it's fine. And Carroll is flustered by this and writes back that surely there are other ways that you can make yourself at home in that community. And just think of the consequences if a priest discharged a gun. Just think that through, please. So it is, and they have respect for each other. Carol knows that Gallitzin is a faithful priest, knows that his heart is in the right place, but there is this constant tension of style there.
Our guest today is Catherine O'Donnell. She is a professor of history at Arizona State University. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin. You're listening to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. We'll be back in a moment.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world with the Catholic Review. The Archdiocese of Baltimore submitted a proposed plan for reorganization May 15th in an effort to complete its Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization with the goal of equitably compensating victims of child sexual abuse by clergy and others affiliated with the Catholic Church in Maryland. The proposal includes establishing a survivor compensation trust totaling at least $168.9 million to evaluate and resolve claims. That amount would be funded by contributions from the Archdiocese and its insurers. Additional funds will be contributed by participating parishes, schools, and related Catholic entities. That amount is still to be calculated. A statement from the Archdiocese said, quote, "At its core, the proposed plan seeks to provide equitable compensation to survivors while sustaining the Church's mission and ministries. It reflects a commitment to transparency and a realistic assessment of available resources. The plan includes $43.9 million from the Archdiocese and at least $125 million combined from two insurance companies that covered parishes, schools, and the Archdiocese during the times covered by some of the claims. Funds to the trust from the Archdiocese would come from unrestricted assets. The plan does not anticipate the Archdiocese selling any real estate, according to Christian Kadzierski, Archdiocesan Executive Director of Communications. The parish or other entities would also contribute from unrestricted assets. Other insurance carriers are expected to contribute to the trust as well. The Archdiocese's proposed plan also includes non-monetary obligations to further enhance the existing child safety and protection policies and procedures within the Archdiocese, which is something the Survivors Committee, known as the Unsecured Creditors Committee, has requested. For more on this and other stories, visit CatholicReview.org. For everyone at Catholic Review Media, I'm Kevin Parks.
This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. We're talking today with Catherine O'Donnell, an author and professor of history at Arizona State University. Catherine has just completed some research on Prince Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin, a Russian nobleman who gave up wealth and status to become a priest on the American frontier in the early days of the American church in the United States. So Catherine, we mentioned in the last segment that Gallitzin was the first pastor of St. Joseph in Tawnytown. He was there for a few years in the Archdiocese of Baltimore, which of course back then took up the whole country. But do we know much about his tenure there at St. Joseph?
We just have a couple of letters that suggest that he had a little bit of trouble working with the Marylanders, who had developed a style of Catholicism that did not expect to be told what to do in every regard by a priest, right? Mm-hmm. So there had not been as many priests in the United States or in the colonies as elsewhere. Some of these Marylanders were very confident that they could run their own lives. Gallitzin actually proposed to John Carroll that Gallitzin go west. I guess that's an American thing to do, right? Go kind of further towards the frontier into a less developed area where he thought he could serve people better, and he hoped serve immigrants and serve people who really wanted to live in a more enclosed Catholic world.
Could you talk about that? Because it's sort of an experiment for him to establish a different way of doing a parish or doing ministry. And what was his vision there?
Yeah, I think so. His vision was much less integrationist than John Carroll's. He really, and he had access to credit, lines of credit, because he was a prince. And because he truly believed he would inherit a lot of money. He did not. So he ended up with a lot of debts. But because he had access to credit and some money, he could establish the economic foundations of this community in Cambria County and Pennsylvania, a lumber mill, maybe a tannery, some other kinds of 19th century economic pieces like that. He bought land and sold it for no profit whatsoever to people who wanted to come, and he wanted them all to be Catholic. And he wanted them to live a life cradle to grave, including schooling, including your economic activity, that would be done in a Catholic world. And so it was, in a way, it was almost like a utopian kind of impulse. There's actually another person who started a more Presbyterian-inflected community not far down the road. But of course, people could come and go, right? The same people who might be interested in coming to a frontier town were maybe exactly the people who didn't want to be told precisely how to live at every moment, right? That's not a perfect match there. And so it's clear that it ended well. As he aged, he may have mellowed. And I think he also just became such an eccentric, beloved figure that people named their children after him and so forth. You can mm-hmm. see it. But his vision of like a little enclave of Catholicism inside the diversity of the United States was really different from Carroll's.
He also went on to do a lot of writing, and he became a pretty effective apologist. I think you talk about that
Yes,
in
I wouldn't, you would never guess, right? Like that he would. English is probably his third language. And again, in person, he was very harsh, but he developed this style. And it's almost like Mark Twain-like, you know, very folksy style on the page. And all of the sharp tongue and criticism that he would direct at parishioners on the page, he just directs it at hypothetical Protestants. And he is very welcoming to anyone who would want to be a Catholic. And his argument is very similar to his argument in developing this community, which is everywhere in the United States, you have to choose and you have to decide, and nothing is certain and everything's unclear. Catholicism gives you paths to God. Catholicism gives you this tradition within which you can live, and it takes so many choices out of your hands. And look at those Protestants, they can't even agree with each other. Obviously, that ends in chaos. So Catholicism is a place of certainty for him, and beauty and peace. And he's very astute in saying, I love the Constitution. The Constitution says everyone can choose, and that's how it should be. I'm just telling you there's only one good choice, and that's Catholicism. And once you make that choice, you don't have to make all these other ones, right? Then you can kind of live inside the certainty that the Catholic Church provides.
A few years ago, I know the cause for his canonization was open. Do you know where that stands? Has there been any progress there?
So I used documents that were compiled as sort of somewhat indirectly, but as part of that process. So a fair amount of labor was put into that. I am not aware that it has advanced. I know because I've gotten email from people every so often, like if I've popped up doing a, you know, having talked about Gallitzin or something, that there are individuals who take this cause very much to heart and continue to pursue it. But I'm not sure exactly where it stands. But there is a wonderful set of documents that have been produced again because of it that make clear his correspondence and his personality, and that are very straightforward too about the conflicts that he got into. So they're very expressive historically.
In doing all this research, what most strikes you about Gallitzin? What would you say you learned, or what's most compelling about him?
Great question. I guess one thing I'm struck by is how, although he seems kind of outlandish and old-fashioned, his insight that people living in modern times with lots of choice and uncertainty might find in a religion, or specifically in Catholicism, peace holds true. And I think that his desire for an all-encompassing religious experience is one that I actually see and hear people talking about more in recent years than even maybe 10 years ago. The idea of like an all-encompassing, meaningful existence that is just threaded through with spiritual confidence and a community is very appealing to people. And the fact that he came out of the situation with his mother, inventing all kinds of new traditions and so forth, made him oddly modern in a sense. I mean, I think that Gallitzin would have looked around and thought, yeah, social media, yep, I could have seen that coming. Or yep, I'm going to make a, he might still be interested in like carving out a little utopia, either virtual or actual, amidst the kind of arguments and chaos. So I guess I've been struck by how he doesn't feel that far away, really.
We have about 30 seconds left. How can people read your latest essay on Gallitzin?
Yes, it is in the US Catholic Historian in the current issue. If anybody wants to write to me, I'm up on the website of Arizona State University, and I'm happy to send you a copy of the article if you'd like that. And it's if you do have the article, it shows you all these other letter collections and so forth that you can get. So you don't have to believe me, but what I say about Gallitzin, you can go right to the sources, which is always a delight.
Okay, great. Our guest today has been Catherine O'Donnell. She's a historian at Arizona State University, and she is an expert on Prince Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin. So, Catherine, thanks again so much for being here on Catholic Review Radio.
Thank you.
For Catholic Review Radio, I'm George Matisek. Thanks for listening.
You're probably not getting much church news in your daily newspaper or on your local TV station. The Catholic Review is the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the Catholic Church full-time. There are so many ways to stay in touch with the Catholic Review. Pick up the monthly magazine at your parish or have it delivered to your home. Get fresh news every day online at CatholicReview.org. Subscribe to our e-newsletter for twice-weekly updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Catholic Review Media will inspire, teach, inform, and engage you wherever your faith takes you. Read it today in print or online at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
Tune in to Catholic Review Radio next week, available on WMET 1160 AM and 103.1 FM. And also WSJF 92.7 FM in the Sykesville area. Check us out at CatholicReview.org/CR-radio. Also on Apple Podcasts, Alexa, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Review Radio. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May Almighty God bless us and keep us always in his love.